From PPRO, this is Payments Radio, the show for and about the payments industry, covering news, interviewing experts, and talking about all the ways the world pays. This week, we bring you Mastercard's move into the SME market, Southeast Asian e-wallet use, a move to cashless society, hawker stores in Singapore, our regular Wirecard corner, and cashierless checkouts in physical stores. My name's Matt. Let's get started. Hey, James, how are you?
I'm doing good, and you, Matt? Back in London.
Very good.
And getting back to normal life.
So you're in quarantine, right, James? How's that been?
Well, I was in quarantine. I was in quarantine for a few days, and then the UK government decided to put Portugal on the official fly list. So I was in quarantine for about 2 days.
Okay. Not suffering as much as some other people.
No. I think I was very lucky in this regard. Only 2 days. But on the downside, I could have maybe spent some more time in Europe with the sunny weather, knowing that I didn't have to come back and self-quarantine for 2 weeks. But that's not what we're here to discuss. We're here to discuss payments, fintech, and not my summer vacation.
Right, let's get into it. So first story we wanted to talk about was MasterCard moving into the SME market. So they're branding it SME in a box. It's a new low-cost payment solution that allows small business owners to move their business online and accept a range of digital payments from their customers. Feels very Stripe, Molly, Square-esque. What are your thoughts, James?
Yeah, MasterCard's always been they've got a very strong partnership model. They partner with a lot of fintechs. They have a lot of accelerator programs where fast-growing or small fintechs can come in and utilize their technology and utilize their platform to build these types of services. And from reading this, it looks like they're partnering with a few businesses. I don't know if they're partnering with some of the businesses that they might have helped accelerate. I should probably look into that. But it certainly looks like they're moving into that space and they're seeing some of the opportunities that the SME space can provide and using that as an accelerator to maybe build your way up the ladder. So good move from MasterCard. It does look like they're taking a very different approach. It's not a typical PSP type solution. They are working with MasterCard Payment Gateway Services, which is their gateway that they use themselves. They also white label for large banks and other PSPs or any financial institution that wants to build a gateway. But they really are building it as a mobile solution or almost like an app. If you're a small business, you download the app, you send payment invoices via the app, and it's not so much go build a website and plug into us as a PSP or a gateway. So it really is an SME in a box.
Very,
very cool.
I think where we see this done really well is that really for these SME merchants, especially at the smaller end of the section, it's pretty much individuals, right? And so you've got to give a great consumer experience. And so, you've got to make it very easy for them to do it because there are other players who their whole business is about making it easy to get online and accept payments. So can someone of the scale of MasterCard do that? Really interesting to watch and see. Lots of competition in that market. And I think the winners here are the SME businesses that are now having another player moving into the market, giving them some more options.
Yeah, it goes towards their overall strategy. MasterCard have made a commitment to bring 1 billion people into the digital economy by 2025. And they're saying here that this includes 50 million small businesses. So they're very successful, I think, on the enterprise level. They're very successful in working with traditional banks and working within the traditional infrastructure. Now moving down to the SME level, to get 50 million small businesses online is no small feat. And they're not going to do it by themselves. The PSPs out there that target SMEs are probably not going to do it by themselves. It's a bit of a collective effort, and I think they're wanting to just take their little piece of the pie.
Interesting. Do we have any insight on geographically where this is focused? I noticed the press release mentions Guarang Shah, the SVP of Product Digital Payments and Labs, Middle East and Africa. So I wonder if this is a play to those markets where we know SME is really important and giving access to financial services in economies like is such an enabler of progress.
Yeah, I think this one here immediately is targeting that region. But I know they've had similar initiatives that have been focusing on Asia Pacific. They've had similar initiatives in North America. And maybe this is part of a bundling exercise to maybe all put it under one brand. But certainly from reading this press release, it seems fairly targeted for this launch. Obviously, when you launch this type of product in a region, you can't copy paste these businesses across the world. You can't say, okay, for the Middle East and Africa, let's build a product and then just copy paste it to North America, Latin America, Asia Pacific. You need so many different partners in each region to help piece the solution together. So you probably find they've got all the right identity providers for this region. They've got all the right banking partners, etc. And they're just using this as a framework to copy paste it to different regions.
Yeah, really good point. And I think across regions, that different level of regulation is one of the biggest blockers to speed of entry. And you know, PPRO are looking into different regions, as we know, and the regulation and how you set up there is one of the biggest challenges to moving quickly.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I mentioned that this is focused on Middle East and Africa, but they've done similar things in other parts of the world, and yeah, the SME market is just huge. And if you think about how many consumers are coming online and beginning to transact on a local basis is mind-boggling. Another study by MasterCard, again, as I'm reading our notes here, found that 40% of consumers in Southeast Asia say they were using e-wallets more than ever. If that's not a call to arms to build these types of products, I don't know what it is. Malaysia's leading the way, it says, yeah, with the use of cash slowly dwindling. Younger populations in the region, millennials, Gen Zs, are the biggest contributor to the growth of digital banking. So you have so many users wanting to use digital banking channels, wanting to use online payment channels. You have to stack your cards on the other side of the house as well and ensure that you can use all of these digital channels at every merchant, not just the large brand names.
Yeah, and I think the really interesting thing about this is that digital services allow access to financial services to people that are either unbanked or underbanked. So yeah, in emerging countries like Indonesia, Thailand, Malaysia, the Philippines, Vietnam, there's a significant proportion of the population that can't access banking services, but they probably do have a mobile phone. It's probably a smartphone. And by providing e-wallets and other services like that, as we've seen in China and other places where there's these mega apps, you bring a whole new raft of people, a bigger portion of the population into retail, into commerce, yeah, and give them access to financial services. And that fuels growth at the micro and macro level.
Yeah, it's pure growth here. It's everybody's moving into digital payments. It's taking some time, but it's something you... If you're left behind at this point in the game, the damage is irreparable. I mean, you're right. It's such an important factor that all of these new payment methods that we continue to evangelize on this podcast it's more than just new consumer experiences. It's more than just, oh, GrabPay is a super app that has such a big reach. It's about bringing new consumers into the financial system, giving them the power and the tools to transact on the same level as everyone else. And it's all of this net new revenue and net new transactions coming into the system. That's the exciting part of it. We've worked in payments for quite some time now. We're not the use case for growth because we're transacting using cards. Whenever I use an e-wallet, I try use it as much as possible. It's the exciting thing is when new groups and new portions of the population are given access to these payment methods and they're now online. They now have access to new services. They now have so much more power than they did in the past.
And I think to pick up a thread that we've probably spoken about on a number of other podcasts that we've done is that for many people, this is their first financial interaction. So they don't have a legacy of banking with a bank that's been around for 120, 150 years. So they're building trust in a new digital partner, and in a way that my folks probably don't trust putting their credit card on their mobile phone, these people will, and they'll grow up and be digitally native, not just in terms of how they use technology in their daily life, so in their financial services. So they never need to have a relationship with a big bank. And this is why we see big incumbents like MasterCard and other banks starting digital-only propositions as a way of recognizing that move market.
Yeah. I think for these new consumers coming onto the scene and trusting digital payments, it takes so much more to get them to trust these providers. Because if I look at my history in payments, or even my history in dealing with banks, I trust my big bank. I've got two bank accounts in the UK. I've got an HSBC account and I've got a Monzo account. I expect completely different things from those two banks. Yeah, when I first had my HSBC account, you'd buy something from the shop, and you know, if that transaction only showed up in the app 2 days later, that was normal. That was fine. Mm-hmm. You know, and you just knew, oh, it's clearing up in the system and that's okay. When I go into Monzo, if it doesn't show up immediately whilst I'm transacting, I'm like, did it go through? Did they get the money? Is something gone wrong? Yeah. Like, what's going on? So I'm expecting that immediate acknowledgement. Now, for somebody completely new and maybe doesn't have that legacy experience with the traditional bank that I have, they expect that immediate confirmation from all of their payment experiences. And as soon as you don't have that, they start to worry, and that's where things break down. And that's why we're getting such good user experiences and such great experiences from these new payment methods. They're just at the forefront of technology, and they have to provide such a good service in order to gain trust. If you use GrabPay in Singapore and your transaction only shows up 2 days later, it's just not good enough. And that's the new norm, which is great.
Fantastic. And another thread that we consistently talk about is that the consumer is at the heart of everything, and these digital user experiences and digital shopping channels firmly place the consumer at the heart of that. Moving on, slightly different, but again, very consumer-centric, is that there's a lot of discussion about the move to a cashless society, even in a Western economy like the UK, as a result of COVID. So, James, are you reticent to use cash? Will you pay for something with a £10 note?
Well, I mean, I'd prefer not to. I've always had a dislike with cash. I like money. Like, it's useful. But I've always had a dislike to carrying cash. I don't enjoy carrying notes. I especially don't enjoy using coins. I find it extremely inefficient. You know, how many you lose coins in your pocket, you've got to count it out. It's a pain. And now with COVID, the fact that people are getting anxious to get on public transport, to get too close to each other, to have to wear masks everywhere, and now it's fine to exchange cash. For me, I mean, this is kind of the final axe in cash's life cycle.
Yeah, really interesting. And I think, again, there's some parts of the population that have only ever used cash, and I think perhaps they're moving slightly towards the cashless society. I'm not sure if they're all the way there. Certainly, I'm not sure they'd be talking about it in the way that you were. Survey mentioned 54% of people worried about touching paper and coins, and 60% said they'll only be using a digital form of payment from now on. So that's still 40%. I wonder, as we move through time and in 20 years, when perhaps our more elderly relatives and friends who've grown up using cash as a dominant form, whether that is the inflection point and we see very little cash about now. I've seen in merchants near me and through posts on social media, very different actions, almost at both ends of the spectrum. Some people saying that the call to move to a cash society is just another form of government control. But then I've seen other things of, you know, friends who are running shops or just saying, I will not be accepting cash anymore. Please don't put my and your health at risk. So polarizing, very interesting.
Yeah.
I can't imagine the last time I withdrew cash from a cash.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to be mistaken here. There's still, in today's society, there's still a need for cash. I do understand that we need cash. There are a lot of consumers out there that do not have access to the financial system, do not have access to a smartphone. do not have access to any of these e-wallets, and they need cash. They do need cash today. But the rate of change and the rate of digitization, the rate of access to these services is so fast and it's changing so quickly. Mm-hmm. I see the runway for cash running out. Part of it's a generational shift. My grandmother used to have a mobile phone. It's an old Nokia, wasn't a smartphone. She never turned it on. She just used it. She just had it for emergencies. Now, I'd never expect her to have a smartphone and download an e-wallet and use digital cash, because you're just not, that's not the best solution for her. But now that a lot of our parents, my dad, he's got a smartphone, kids these days, I mean, for us, we're a digital generation, you know. For the rest of our lives, we're going to have a smartphone or some form of digital form of payment in our pocket. And it's just time. It's just a matter of time until 99% of the population has that form of digital payment, use that form of digital payment, prefers that form of digital payment. And there you are.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I think leading into our next story that we'd like to discuss is you need merchants to accept that. And in certain use cases, cash has been the only way to pay. In the hawker stalls in Singapore, great place to go if you're ever in Singapore, nearly a third of them now offer e-payment as an option. That's amazing and just very indicative of even the hardest use cases that need cash in the past are now finding a way.
Yeah, I mean, and it's probably so much easier for those hawker stalls. It's they can just concentrate on serving their customers. They can concentrate on making the delicious food that you can get there. My mouth's actually salivating as we discuss this, because it's going to make their life much easier. But it's amazing to see how much that number's jumped. How many of them are actually digital? I wouldn't be surprised if in 6 to 12 months that's up at 2/3 or even up there. Also, if you look at the barriers to accepting these types of payments, it's becoming lower and lower and lower. When we're talking about a card-dominated market, you need a POS machine, you need merchant accounts, you need to buy this hardware. For e-wallets, your mobile phone turns into your terminal. You can place a QR code just on the window of your store, and that makes it much easier to accept these payments, and it makes the barrier so low that once you're in, you're in for good.
Yeah, yeah, and I think the really interesting thing here is that this was a government push, right? So the government wanted the hawker stalls to go digital and incentivized them to do that. So they offered bonuses. So to qualify for the bonus, stall holders must have completed at least 20 transactions each month worth at least $1 each by May the 31st, 2021. And they'll give a bonus of $300 each month for up to 5 months. And, you know, governments are sometimes slow to lead the way on innovation, but it seems the Singapore government here has really moved things forward in a big way.
Yeah. I mean, this is one of those topics where I'm sure somebody will come back and say, we don't trust the system. We don't want to declare any of this. I mean, depending on the merchant type, there are some benefits to cash, and they probably don't want the government to see it. That's not right. I'm definitely not advocating for that. But I'm sure there's some hesitation in the hawker market. But I think I truly do believe that the benefits outweigh any negative that type of oversight.
Yeah, back to your earlier sentiment, either do it or get left behind, right? And if you're a hawker stall amongst five others and the rest of them are offering e-payment and you're not, you'll soon start to lose out, because that is what consumers want to do, especially in the post-COVID world.
Yeah. If I have a choice between two different hawker stalls, one has a line because they got to figure out with cash and I have to carry more coins in my pocket versus a QR code that I have to scan, I think you'll know which one I'll choose.
Definitely, definitely. Jumping now to our regular feature, I think we'll call it Wirecard Corner. Couple of big stories coming out this week of interest. We still haven't got that jingle. We're working on it. But the first one being that Jan Marsalek, the COO, he's been added to Interpol's most wanted list.
Yeah, that's some big news. That's Hollywood headlines here. I'm waiting for a script to come out about the Wirecard movie at some stage, because it's straight out of a Hollywood movie at this point in time.
I've heard that there is at least one Netflix show being made about this already. So scripts have been Netflix have commissioned it, and you know how quickly they move on stuff like this. I cannot wait to watch it.
Coming December 2020.
The allegation against him is that he conspired to obtain about 3.2 billion euros in fraudulent loans, which inflated the books with fake assets and made the company more attractive to investors. They're not sure where he is. He's either in Belarus or Russia. Knowing what's going on in those two countries at the moment, I would be guessing that we're not going to find him anytime soon.
It'll be part of the ongoing story, that's for sure. I don't think we're going to see him being uncovered anytime soon.
No. On more positive news, Railsbank, a UK bank, is going to buy Wirecard UK, which is very positive. I think Wirecard UK was completely segregated, as I understand it, from any of this wrongdoing, but did suffer by being associated with the brand. So great news that the team and the individuals involved in Wirecard UK seem to have a way forward. Very interesting that it's Railsbank. I don't know too much about them, James. Do you?
I mean, I know a lot about the bank. It's a great company. I know some of the guys at the business. But I think the biggest story here, it's reassuring to know that the Wirecard's UK business is going to continue. Hopefully continue. I'm sure they've lost a lot of clients. But the technology that they were offering was very good, and they were very successful. If we think about the fintech ecosystem in the UK, and also the fintech system out of the UK globally, Wirecard was the platform was responsible for a lot of these neobanks, was responsible for a lot of these payment channels in a white label form. That's great to see that. Hopefully that'll continue through this new this new acquisition by Railsbank. That's Railsbank's entire business. They want to be this white label. I mean, it says it all in the name, Railsbank. They want to be the rails for banks. And now this is a very complementary product to them, because it brings more of the front end capabilities to their product.
Yeah, I think at their peak, Wirecard UK settled car payments for about 70 UK clients, and as you mentioned, most of those were the neobanks within the UK. So high user acquisition, a great business model to be supplying companies like that, I think. Alongside the Wirecard UK deal, we understand that the Brazilian Wirecard operation has been sold to PagSeguro, and there's a deal in place for the North American operation, which should be announced shortly. So great news, I think, that individuals and business propositions haven't completely been taken down by a rogue element within a much bigger corporation. Any individual.
Yeah, I mean, fundamentally, the technology was great. The business was great. The technology was extremely successful. So it's going to live just under a different brand in each region. It's just a pity that there was all this fraud behind it.
Yeah. In a much more positive way, James found a very cool article on YouTube from Bloomberg Technology about an autonomous retail checkout. We'll link the video in the show notes. James, tell us about it. What are we watching when we watch this video?
Yeah, I mean, I was watching TV the other day and came across this, and it immediately reminded me of Amazon Go. So I've tried out an Amazon Go store in San Francisco. I mean, it really is the future of retail. You walk in, scan your phone, the Amazon Go shop tracks everything you buy. You don't need a checkout, you just walk out. And now I came across this business, Standard Cognition. It's the exact same technology, but just they've taken it one step further and they've white labeled it. So you could walk in. It's completely cashless. You can walk into the store. You don't have to sign in. You don't have to scan a QR code. Anybody can. Well, if you're registered with the store, you can walk in, literally pick up a chocolate bar off the shelf, put it in your pocket, walk out, and the store will track that purchase, and it will charge you immediately. You can go in with a bag, handbag, whatever you shop with, put as many items in the bag as you want, like a normal retail experience, walk out and it'll do it. So it's going to be very interesting to see this technology being used outside of Amazon, because the only provider we've seen that's been testing out this technology has been Amazon with Amazon Go. Now the standard cognitions clearly done a wonderful job in taking that idea and moving it to the next step. It's going to be very nice to see this being put into place with other retailers and seeing how this technology is utilized.
Yeah, a couple of things that sort of jumped out to me. So the first one was it picks up your face, you're registered, and it's got facial recognition that recognize you in the store. Incredible technology. The other cool thing was that it showed two people passing goods around and it tracks those goods. Yeah. So it's super advanced in that, you know, we could go into a store and be like, hey, James, look at the name of this chocolate bar because I've got a child's sense of humor. You would laugh. I would pass it to you. You might put it in your bag or put it back on the shelf. But all of that's been tracked, which is super cool. I think we spoke a couple of weeks ago about how physical retail on the high street will change and adapt to a post-COVID world. It feels a long way from being post-COVID. But, you know, cool store experiences like this would make me want to go into a store again in a way that, you know, I had to go and buy my son some shoes last weekend and I was masked up in a shopping mall, following a one-way system, and it just wasn't an enjoyable experience. But post-COVID, does this take me more into stores because it's cool and it's frictionless? Probably does. And then the other thing is the payment becomes an online payment. So we talk a lot because of PPRO and our value proposition about the importance and emergence of online payments. But what if online payments are the only payment and all retail stores move to this and all payments are online? What a fantastic industry to be in.
I mean, it'll be very cool to see this in action. And you say the word cool. It's very rare that this type of technology or payments or anything has that cool tag. You know, it's always been a hassle. It's always been a point of friction. We're moving away from that point of friction to invisible payments, and that's where we're walking towards. And this really isn't about the payments piece here. The payments is obviously built in it through an e-commerce payment, but the whole experience, because you're buying something, I'm going to group it into the payments piece. It is cool. It is really cool. I would go and shop. I mean, when I went to go to the Amazon Go store, I didn't need anything. I wasn't hungry or thirsty. I wanted to go there just because it was very cool. And I think more people will want to do this, especially with COVID. I did it because I was a bit of a payments geek. Now in a post-COVID world, I think a lot of my friends would want to go and check this out and give it a test drive.
Yeah, for sure. And I think invisible payments is another topic. Maybe we can spend some time on that on another podcast. But this is great for this use case. It's showing like a grocery store and perhaps you buy clothes with it, but I'm probably not very comfortable spending over £1,000 on a new TV in an invisible way. And nor would the store be, I guess. And walk out.
Yeah, I think there's a few use cases that this is geared for right now. But I think it'll evolve over time. I've bought a few things from the Apple Store using the Apple Store app. And I've walked in, scanned it with my phone, scanned, checked myself out, and I walked out and it was a couple hundred goods. Obviously, it wasn't a laptop or a MacBook or an iPhone because those you have to get from the back room, but it was some of the items in the front of the store. I felt really bad walking out of the store. I thought I was stealing something. I really thought I was doing something wrong because I didn't have that interaction. I did it again 6 months later and I felt more comfortable and I got used to it. So we might see a little bit of that psychology and that mentality around these stores. But we'll get over it. I think that the novelty, there's more of a novelty around this than, let's say, the Apple Store experience that I mentioned. So I think we'll get over it very quickly.
Yeah. And then again, from a consumer point of view, I probably don't want to have to register for every store in a shopping mall. So the idea of a digital identity or store, being able to share my digital identity across multiple use cases, I think is going to become more and more important. There's some really cool propositions popping up around that space.
We need to get into the identity space a little bit. We haven't discussed that yet on the podcast. So maybe over the next week we'll do some research and we can dive into that, because that's another topic where we can have a lot of fun.
Yeah, for sure. And I think we know a few people that are going to be much more informed than us. So maybe we can do that as our first guest appearance.
True. Okay, great. Well, thanks for the time, everyone. Well, thanks for the time, Matt. And thanks for listening, everyone. If you like this episode, please subscribe. Don't forget to leave us a great review. It helps other people find the show. And if you know somebody who loves payments, please pass on the podcast. You can find us at ppro.com. That's ppro.com, or email us at paymentsradio@ppro.com.